Daniel Mahunty is from the Center for Civilians in Conflict in Washington, D.C. He spent 16 years in the U.S. State Department working on, among other things, integrating human rights into U.S. security assistance and arms sales. We spoke earlier.
There may not be anything implicitly wrong with trying to increase the defense industrial base of your country, and certainly there are economic advantages and possibly even bona fide security advantages to be had by undertaking a sale of any one weapon system. But you really have to look at the specific risk of the specific item and the context in which it's sold to understand completely sort of what risks are there, and then to ensure that your controls both before the sale and then after the sale are appropriate. But in many ways, the system or the structure is not situated in such a way that it can control some of the highest or the most riskiest transactions.
What's a U.S. example of that?
I think a good example that we're looking at now, I mean, it is the Saudi Arabia case, where we do have on the book several, you know, regulations and laws and procedures in place that would govern high-risk sales when there's a strong likelihood that the weapon would be used, in a way that's not consistent with its intent. Saudi is an interesting case study because there are fragments of U.S.-made precision-guided munitions, for example, that have been found in pieces of civilian infrastructure. And the difficulty really is that it's hard to point a smoking gun at any sort of specific unlawful act in that case. So, for example, if the U.S. is not willing to say, look, we have enough access to their systems and understood what happened in that precise moment in the targeting cell, to say that that was an illegal act, it's difficult to say that fragment necessarily was part of something that was not supposed to happen. That's what I mean, and what we mean when we say sort of the horse getting out of the stable, and why it can be so difficult. Because once they have it, and the way that they use it, you may not be able to fully evaluate precisely, you know, what's lawful and what's unlawful.
The Australian focus looks to be on technology components, radar, vehicles, rather than things that can shoot people. What sort of risks are there in those sorts of sales?
I think in a lot of cases, the particular item may seem on its surface to not, you know, include a lot of inherent risk. I think it's important to understand how a system or an article fits into a system, and then how that relates to how the purchasing country or purchasing entity intends to use it. It may seem relatively innocuous to provide a part, but can that part be combined with other parts in order to create a system and to be used in such a way that that the seller never fully intended? And I think once the item is gone, it's very difficult to control once it's on the other end.
It's also interesting, isn't it, to contemplate countries like the Philippines, for example, which has been a staunch US ally for so long, but is now looking towards China. I mean, if you sell arms to the Philippines and its relationship with China becomes even more robust, you know, you can see where I'm going with that question. I mean, how much risk is there in the shifting alliances around us?
Well, I think it's certainly something the United States has to consider as it, you know, arms its allies and partners and others. I mean, for example, if you're selling to a country in the current moment on the basis of terrorism, you have to think sort of second and third order effects in terms of, you know, larger kind of balance of power and technology parity. So I do think that for at least for the U.S. government, has been one of the primary concerns always related to its arms sales program. And that's why I think the controls on U.S. exports have largely been to prevent that kind of technological parity.
You've worked on efforts to integrate human rights in U.S. security assistance and trying to prevent the use of child soldiers and policies on protecting civilians in conflict. We have aid organisations in Australia saying the Australian government just should not be getting into this in any deep way in a world that's uncertain and awash with conflict, essentially a moral argument. Is that valid if Australia's not in that space? Is that a valid argument to keep us out of it?
I think there are more than just moral arguments to make the case that any country that's selling weapons should consider the second and third order effects, especially when it comes to the violation of human rights or the exacerbation of conflict dynamics. And this is why in our most recent report, we really do try to make the recommendation that particular items need to be examined for the recipient and its past behavior and its prospective behavior in the future, and then also the context in which it's being sold in terms of the risk of conflict or an existing armed conflict. So I don't think it's as easy, and I don't think it would be, at least for our organization or in the United States, effective to say, you know, stop all arms sales because there are moral reasons to do it. I think you've got to kind of look for ways to minimize or mitigate the risk of sales. And in some cases, I think you very well could say, you know, you shouldn't sell a particular item to a particular partner, but it's a difficult case to make. The economic, you know, incentives are so very strong for manufacturers and for the governments that are involved.
Daniel Mahanty, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel Mahanty from the Center for Civilians in Conflict in Washington, D.C.